everyone, and welcome to episode 80 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. When we look back, it's usually possible for people even slightly in the know to name the kings of a certain country. Often it's princes, maybe a bit less often it's queens. But how many of us can name a kingdom's princesses? It's really easy to follow in the footsteps of medieval chroniclers and to think of a princess's worth or her life solely in terms of the marriage market, or perhaps to believe that their lives are unknowable to us. But as it turns out, sometimes we can get a fairly clear picture of a princess, or five, and get to know them as the people they were. And what lies behind dry lists of goods procured might just be some of the most memorable and powerful people of their generation. Dr. Kelsey Wilson-Lee is the head of programs at England's Architectural Heritage Fund and the author of several articles appearing in places like BBC History Magazine. She's also the author of Daughters of Chivalry, The Forgotten Children of Edward I. I invited Kelsey to come on the podcast to tell us about these five forgotten daughters and why each of them is actually unforgettable in her own right. Here's our conversation about life as a real medieval princess, and why Edward's daughters wouldn't have recognized themselves in the typical fairy tale role. Thanks for joining me, Kelsey, to talk about the Daughters of Chivalry. These are Edward I's daughters. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you, and I enjoyed the book, so I'm excited to start talking about this. So I think we should start at the beginning. For the people who don't know, who is Edward I?
So Edward I is in North America, often remembered as Longshanks, largely through a certain Mel Gibson film, which will remain nameless. But Edward I was a king who came to power in 1272 and had a surprisingly long reign, not quite as long as his father, but still pretty long. He died in 1307. So during this time, he is well remembered for having He successfully invaded and conquered Wales, subdued Wales. He tried and never was successful in conquering Scotland. He is remembered as the Hammer of the Scots. He tried to go to war against France. He was quite a military-minded king, also quite a successful administrator. He's remembered mostly for his many and very expensive wars, but he was a kind of ideal medieval king. Not necessarily a nice man in the way we would think of an ideal person now, but he embodied kind of the model of kingship where, being a warrior, he was a crusader king, the only crusader king of his generation. He was a very pious man, so he kind of embodied a lot of these ideals. I tend to think of Edward I as a great king and probably not necessarily a great guy, if one can be allowed that juxtaposition.
Yes. Well, I mean, he's been described as a great and terrible king, right? And that ended up being the title of Mark Morris's biography of him.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think that you can't really look at him without seeing that complication of his being in some ways a great king, but also not a very nice person, especially if you're Welsh or Scottish, right?
Or Jewish.
He
expelled the Jews from England. Yeah, he has certainly very many significant flaws from our vantage point. But interestingly, something that he wouldn't necessarily have been given a lot of credit for by contemporaries, but to us might make him slightly more sympathetic, is he had a close family relationship with not only his wife. He famously had a very close relationship with his wife, was famously loyal to her, which was quite rare. And also had this very intense relationship with his daughters. Slightly more troubling relationship with his son, who, you know, we can talk about that in a bit. But he had kind of a gentler, more, I guess, you know, easygoing, what we would think of as a kind of natural paternal child relationship with his daughters than many, many other kings at the time did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost, as you say, surprising, almost startling, how much of a family man he was, while at the same time being an absolutely ruthless king in other ways. Okay, so let's get into that. So Edward married his wife Eleanor when they were teenagers, right? So how did that go?
So yeah, so they were married in the 1250s. Eleanor of Castile, a Castilian princess who came over from Spain to marry Edward. They were almost he was a couple years older than her. They were both teenagers, and they had a, there was a, their early years were very intense because the, that was kind of the, this was the period leading up to the baronial rebellion and under, you know, Simon de Montfort, and Edward's father, Henry III, very nearly lost the throne during this time. And this was the time of Edward and Eleanor's kind of early marriage. So I think the intensity possibly of these early years really kind of bonded them together. They stayed famously together throughout their many decades of marriage. They were constantly traveling, both from place to place, town to town within England, but also much farther afield. They went together, not just to Wales, to France, to kind of visit parts of her patrimony in northern France and places in Gascony, which were at that point held by the English. But also they went as far as on crusade together. They went to the Holy Land, and Eleanor came with him everywhere, as indeed her own mother had traveled with her father when he had been on military campaigns. So it was clearly, it was a model Eleanor had picked up from her own mother, and it was one that her daughters would go on to emulate as well.
Yeah, and I think we should get into how they traveled together as a whole family in a couple of minutes. But okay, so we've got Edward, we've got Eleanor, they're married, and they have, I think Eleanor had 16 pregnancies, like a huge amount.
A lot
amount.
Of kids.
Yeah.
A lot. Feel deeply sympathetic for Eleanor.
Right. All this traveling while pregnant. Wow, what a woman.
Traveling on horseback while pregnant, you know, constantly. And she also kept hunting through all of her pregnancies. She was a keen huntress. But yes, so they had lots of children. And one of the kind of deeply upsetting things that you have to get past quite quickly is that almost, you know, the majority of those children did not make it past early childhood, you know, and this is the king and queen, you know, these are not people without resource. These are not people without access to the best nutrition and medical advice that existed within that time. And yet Eleanor's 15, 16 pregnancies, only six children survive past, you know, past the age of 10. And that, this is an issue of a lot of debate about to what extent were parents impacted by those deaths of children? And, you know, we can have different perspectives and we can argue different sides of that. But certainly, I would imagine it would be affecting. If it is affecting people as much as we would be is a different question. But it certainly, it wouldn't have been easy. So they have all these different children, and five daughters and one son end up surviving. And the son, the one son that ends up surviving, is their very last child, the last of all of them. So he's got five older sisters, and the five older sisters were the subject of my book.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things that's important that you've obviously mentioned in the book that's important for people to recognize is throughout the life, especially of their oldest daughter, who's named Eleanor, she's always the third in line to the throne. And when you think about it, I mean, so often, especially with daughters, princesses, they're shunted to the side. But you have to recognize when you're looking at Eleanor's life that she was always in some way an heir to the throne, first with her brother Alfonso and then her brother Edward. So can you talk a little bit about what that would have been like for Eleanor being raised as kind of an heir to the throne?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting when you look at the way when you have five princesses in one generation, which is quite rare in the medieval period. Most people didn't have that many kids who survived. But when you have that many, you can really see how they are treated differently depending on their birth order. And Eleanor, from an early age, as you were saying, there's always a kind of a little sickly boy standing between her and the throne.
Yeah.
There are a succession of little boys who are around for a few years and then don't survive. Edward, the one who ended up becoming her brother, who ended up becoming Edward II, Prince Edward, he's many, many years younger. She was a teenager before he was born. So throughout much of her childhood, she is very much treated as the kind of, I suppose, the spare within the heir and the spare. You know, she's the extra one. Obviously not ideal being a female, but her father does take legal steps to ensure that if he dies without a male heir, that she herself will become the heir of the throne. I mean, obviously, within a primogeniture situation, which is what we have, the transition of land and estates through the male line. Generally, if you are a nobleman and you don't have any sons and you have a series of daughters, your estate will be divided up equally between those female heirs. You can't do that if you have a kingdom at stake. So Edward does take steps to ensure that Eleanor's rights as the heir are protected. And he also is clearly, there's little hints here and there where he's clearly educating her more about statecraft. She is participating in signing charters in her own name at the age of about 12. This is one of the wonderful charter where she agrees that she kind of licenses her father's ambassadors to go act on her behalf to help arrange a marriage for her that doesn't end up coming off, but would have made her Queen of Aragon. And it's quite rare to see a 12-year-old female signing these charters in her own name. And it's in her voice. Nevertheless, obviously quite a formal charter. You know, the charter is a very formal language, but she speaks, you know, about herself giving this permission. So you get the sense that Eleanor is designed, she's being trained to be a prince. And you don't get that with her younger siblings, her younger sisters, who were never in that same position.
Yeah, they all have kind of a different role. But thinking of Eleanor as being trained as a prince, I think that's a good way of thinking of it. When her parents are in the country, Eleanor is going with them pretty much everywhere. She's going into like hostile territory in Wales. She's learning about how to do things. And as you say, she has a lot of agency in that she's trying things out by herself as an administrator, which I think is really, as you had said, is rare and also a very interesting thing to look at and something that we don't look at a lot when we look at princesses.
No, that's right. And, you know, of course, all women were trained to be able to administer estates, noble women. You know, we haven't, they needed to be because as Eleanor finds out later in her life, when many, many years later, her husband, and she's off living in northern France, and her husband is captured and is held hostage. And she, you know, the administration of the county that she's in falls to her. You know, she is responsible legally for looking after this county on behalf of her husband, who can't do it because he's being held hostage. So it is something that there is an awareness within medieval culture that women, noble women, might be in this position where they need to act as an administrator of an estate. They need to have enough knowledge about how to do that, that they're not going to, if they're in that position, they're not going to kind of let everything fall apart. So they need to, women kind of were trained and taught to be able to do that. But she was trained and taught to be able to do it at the level of a kingdom, if need be. And I think she comes across very much, very serious, quite dutiful individual.
Yes. And there are so many records that kind of get at her as a person that there's one point at which you say, you know, she dies and there's not even a ripple. You know, people almost don't mention it in the records. And you mentioned that it's surprising and you said it's strangely painful. And I really did feel that, you know, you get to know Eleanor through the records of what she asks for, what she does, how she uses her influence with her father, which she does very responsibly. As you say, she's a perfect daughter. And then she just disappears and it is painful.
It is. And I think it shows the difference of the way that women are treated in different kinds of historical sources. So where we get the notices about the death of kings is in chronicles. You know, we get kind of the king died and this was horrible and, you know, these things happened. And where we get information about these women is from kind of receipts of things that they've bought or they've purchased, or, you know, rare surviving letters and charters and things like that, where we get this kind of detail about the women that fleshes them out and makes them seem like real people. These women are almost completely absent from these great chronicle sources that tell us about the deaths of kings, right? So we don't know about their deaths because the sources that would tell us that are uninterested in these women. They're really the only thing they normally tell us about these women. They're really basically the only time they normally show up is when they marry some other important man, you know? Mm-hmm. And at that point, they are simply, the women are serving as the bridge between England and this other kind of kingdom or whatever the area is. Yeah. So it's why you have to look for different sources if you're interested in women.
Yeah. And I think that that brings me to one of the other sisters. I'm not going in birth order here, but like one of the pictures that you have in here is a genealogical chart of Edward's daughters. And it doesn't even mention Mary, who, because she has become a nun, she's not getting married. But boy, is Mary in the receipts, right?
She sure is. Yeah, no, I think Mary, yeah, if you were strictly looking at this wonderful genealogical chart, and it has, you know, Edward, and it has Eleanor of Castile, and then it's got little pictures. They are almost contemporary, not quite contemporary, but they're little pin drawings of women's faces. And you think, wow. And yet you look at this, and if that was your key source, you would say Edward and Eleanor had four daughters, because Mary's completely not there at all. Uninteresting to the genealogist, because she didn't procreate. But yes, you're right. If you look in the receipts and the records of bills paid off and gambling debts paid off, you will find plenty of Mary. Yes. Mary is everyone's favorite body nun. You know, she, for all that, you know, the idea of a nun was a kind of, you know, very pious vow, you know, thinking of vows of poverty and simple living. Mary is none of that. Mary is flamboyant and, you know, fairly outlandish at times. And certainly she lived her best life, I think, is one can say.
Yeah, she went into so much debt at some point that I think you said her goldsmith went to debtor's prison.
Her goldsmith had to be, yes, her father had to pay off her debts to the goldsmith to get him released from debtor's prison. I mean, that's a lot of bling, isn't it? So, yes, for a nun, imagine underneath the robes what must have been there. But yes.
Mary is, she's definitely a character for sure. She's not somebody who, you know, you would think of as the dutiful daughter. But at the same time, Edward, who's this very stern king, is just indulging her. He just pays for it and pays for it and pays for it. And Mary gets invited to all the parties and they visit her at the abbey too. So this kind of, to me, it speaks to their familial relationship. Like they're actually going out of their way to visit her.
Yes. I mean, they are a close family. I think Edward had a lot of guilt that he put Mary in the convent. So Mary went into the convent at the age of 6, yeah, which was not really supposed to happen. And she joined the convent in order to be a companion to her grandmother. It was her grandmother who, after living a life at court, Eleanor of Provence, her grandmother wanted to retire to become a nun, but didn't want to give up all of her grandchildren. So took a couple of them with her. Mm-hmm. And Mary's mother, Eleanor of Castile, was not happy about the fact that her daughter was being consigned to a convent at the age of 6. She tried to protest, was not successful. But I think that a lot of Edward's kind of indulgence of Mary later on can probably, I would argue, could potentially be at least traced back to guilt. I guess one of the things I think is very interesting about Mary is a lot of the kind of flamboyance can look very, it strikes us as inappropriate for a nun, as unusual. Sure, we can kind of, you know, to a certain extent, we can kind of laugh about it. But I think some of what she was doing was demonstrating her connection to court. When she travels, when she has a very lavish table, she's demonstrating that you know, she's the daughter of the king, and that buys her a certain amount of power. Whereas all of her sisters all had positions as daughters of the king, but also connected to their husbands. They were countesses, they were duchesses. One of them was, in her own right, one of the greatest landowners in Britain after her first husband's death. Mary had no connection that gave her power other than the connection to her father. And I think that some of the flamboyance could actually have been that, her trying to demonstrate that connection, which gave her the additional kind of access to power.
Yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for Mary. I mean, you do have to laugh at the sheer extravagance when you compare it to the lifestyle she was supposed to be living.
Indeed.
But yeah, I do have a lot of sympathy for her. And I think you're right in that a lot of Edward's actions, I think, could be explained by kind of paternal guilt, because mm-hmm. Margaret and Elizabeth both really dig their heels in about being shipped off to be married. And he kind of, he's not happy about it. I think he throws Margaret's crown in the fire, right? But he's not
Elizabeth.
Happy about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
It's Elizabeth's?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But he allows it to a point. And I think that's because he has a relationship with them as people, and it's got to be hard for them, you know, to have your daughter begging to not be sent over to a different country, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, we sometimes, you know, think of these things as women going off to marry some guy they don't know. And I'm sure there was lots of that. But actually, in this case, these were women being sent off to marry some guy they did know quite well, because he'd been living at the English court. Yeah. And maybe they knew they didn't like him
much. Yeah, yeah. You know?
And there's a lot that's quite easy to sympathize with. But one of the things I find very interesting about this is ultimately, you know, everybody, even when Edward was able to kind of give them the kind of, you know, stay of execution to a certain extent, Margaret got married and still stayed in England for another 5 years. Elizabeth had a kind of year-long sabbatical away from her new husband. But eventually they needed to go because, you know, England needed them to go be the representative of the connection. In both of their cases, both Elizabeth and Margaret married into powers that were very important for the English wool trade. And when the economy of England is, you know, heavily dependent on wool, and your father is running a bunch of very expensive wars and needs to keep the money coming in, and you have the ability to do something about that, you, the individual princess, I find it quite interesting that they all actually ultimately, despite their clear personal preference not to, they went off and did the dutiful thing. And I think you can see within that them playing an important role that goes beyond being a pawn. They are actually an active participant in England's diplomatic maneuvering on a kind of European stage. I find that is a useful and I think much more active way to think about these marriages rather than thinking about these women as mere pawns of their father.
Yeah, exactly. They did not want to go. They did dig their heels in, but eventually they did go.
Yeah.
And they did what they were supposed to do, what they were trained to do, what they were asked to do as well. So
And actually, you know, what they were ultimately, yeah, what they were trained to do. And actually, they were, many of them were very successful. Margaret did not have a great relationship with her husband. At no point did their relationship dramatically improve. But she was actually she matured as she grew up into quite a decent diplomat. You know, we see her negotiating trade deals between her duchy in Brabant and Brussels and England well into her married life. And that shows the kind of that there is a role. It's not just get married, have kids, that's it. You know, you actually, there was the role of the consort was a political role that had kind of continuing presence and importance for both sides, both countries.
Speaking of important political roles, that brings us to Joanna, the second oldest. Joanna's probably the most colorful of all of them. Like when you think of like sheer guts, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about, about Joanna.
Joanna is most people's favorite. She's quite bold, maybe a little brash. She's just a bit different from all the rest of them from the beginning. And I think that she did not know any of her other siblings until she was six. She lived, for slightly complex reasons, she lived at her grandmother's court in northern France for her earliest years. And there is just a kind of independent streak that in Joanna that is never washes out. She is married, but the most kind of stereotypical in your mind pawn, you know, princess is a pawn marriage of any of these daughters is Joanna's first marriage. She is married at the age of 15 to one of her father's most powerful but also most difficult subjects, Gilbert de Clare, who is a very important marcher lord. All of Glamorgan has vast counties throughout England. And he is about 40, vastly older than her, already married, has some kids whom he disinherited to marry Joanna. Very complex. But what's really interesting about Joanna is when Gilbert de Clare dies, she has four children. She is about 23, 24 years old. And suddenly she is the sole landowner of one of the largest estates in Britain, including vast amounts of this land in Wales and the Welsh Marches, which is particularly important because the jurisdiction of the march meant that within Wales, within Glamorgan, she basically was kind of, you know, almost like a queen in her own area. She had, there was much less oversight on behalf of what that her father had. But she has this wonderful situation where she's suddenly one of her father's most important lords. And then their relationship kind of changes overnight from her being his daughter, his quite slightly headstrong daughter, to suddenly being one of his kind of vassals, you know, his feudal vassals. Yeah, I mean, it'd be wonderful to say. And she settled down very nicely into her kind of role. She absolutely did not. She continued to give her father all kinds of difficulty, eloping with a nobody who she nearly lost everything out of marrying this young man who seems to have come completely from nowhere. But ultimately, she wins her father around and she gets to hold her estate and remain married to this man who is, it's clearly a love match. And she wins her father around because actually she knows him and she knows how to appeal to him in a way that will work. And she's quite savvy. You know, she's definitely not an easygoing person. I don't know that Joanna would have been a great friend.
No.
But she comes across as very determined and certainly very one of those people who they're just going to make sure they're just going to get it done, you know. And I'm from the American South, and there's a phrase, come hell or high water, that we use. And that's kind of reminds me of Joanna. I think she was going to do what she was going to do. And gosh, you better not get in her way.
Yeah.
Happily, it did work out for her.
Yeah.
Eventually.
I think I would rather be friends with Eleonora for sure. But like reading of Joanna's story is amazing. So she marries Ralph. She gets him knighted to try and elevate him a little bit. But of course, as soon as her father finds out, you know, he jails her husband and stuff. And
yeah.
She still manages to stand up to him.
Jails the new husband, confiscates all the lands, takes your children takes her existing children into custody. Yeah, but she goes and finds him and pleads with him and gets away with it in the end.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting to think. I guess I would say Eleonora would be a really interesting friend. Mary would have thrown the best parties. Joanna, you know, if you had a difficult thing that needed to get done, she'd be the one to see it through. And Elizabeth, who we haven't talked about that much, but really as always strikes me as quite a sentimental person. There's a kind of niceness, an inherent goodness to Elizabeth that comes across quite well. She was very, very attached to her family. Mm-hmm. And that comes across. She kind of, even as an adult, largely lives within her father's court and is very close with him, even as an adult. So I think they each have these kind of different personalities. And I tend to think of them in my mind, you know, the five sisters. It's not unlike, you know, in Pride and Prejudice, so you've got the five Bennet girls with the different personalities. I tend to think of these as a kind of a pack in that way.
Yeah, and the way they treat each other. And there's such sibling things that happen in here. You know, I think it's easy to forget when you look at people that are so far in the past or people who are so elevated in their position to not think of them as siblings. But there is this moment where, and I've, you know, I like looking into English history, I like looking into this era. And I think many of us know about the moment where Edward I, he throws out Piers Gaveston. He gets very angry at his son, Edward, and strips him of everything. Basically, you're grounded. But I didn't realize that at that moment, like Joanna gives her little brother her seal and is like, it's fine. Like, I'll sneak you out the back. You can spend whatever money you want. Like, what? That is such a sibling thing to do, you know?
It is. It was a big sister being like, don't worry, I'll sort it out. I'll calm dad down. You know, I have to say that moment where Joanna sends her brother his seal, which was just, I almost kind of, you know, was gobsmacked. It's a kind of gesture of, it was quite breathtaking bravado. Yeah. Nobody else could have gotten away with it. Anyone else would have gotten huge amounts of trouble from Edward.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
You know, the idea, even her brother, even Prince Edward, you know, immediately kind of disavows the action. It's like, I promised dad I didn't ask for her seal. Here, have the seal back, you know. But it's a wonderful thing. And of course, you know, I mean, the seal is, this is his Edward the King is trying to make his son, is trying to bring him to heel and to control him by controlling his spending power. And if he can't spend, if he can't, doesn't have any money, he has to kind of, you know, shape up and do what his dad says. But yes, his sister then hands him the equivalent of a Black American Express and says, go have fun. It's an astonishingly provocative act, actually. And nobody else, I don't think, could have gotten away with it.
No, I know. And he, like, Edward the father, he lets her get away with it eventually. I mean, he's pretty angry, but, like, I mean, I think at that point you got to expect that kind of stunt from Joanna. But it's almost stunning to me that never makes it into the stories of the relationship between the two men. Joanna's part in it is erased when really this would have been a huge moment for the family. Like, this would have been an awkward Christmas gathering, you know, after that. So it's kind of a big deal.
I think they had a couple of awkward Christmas gatherings. But, you know, I mean, one of the most shocking things for me when I started working on the research for this book was I am a historian of late medieval England, and I'm particularly interested in the 13th, 14th centuries. This is my period. This is my area. And I did not know these stories before I started this project. I did not really, I kind of had a vague notion there were some girls in the family, but I didn't know about them. And I didn't know that. I also was completely, I had this, I guess, kind of intuitive feeling that there wasn't that much to be known, that there weren't any records. And maybe they were interesting, but we would never know. And we couldn't know. And therefore, it was very, very enlightening for me when I kind of started working with the wardrobe accounts that actually they're just all over the place in these accounts. And you can piece them together bit by bit. And it's quite painstaking, but you can get there and actually tell a quite compelling narrative about them. And you can really get to kind of know them as people.
Yeah. In the last episode of the podcast, I was talking to Jack Hartnell about, you know, objects can tell us a lot about how they were used in society and things like that. And it's almost the same thing where you can reconstruct relationships in a way by looking at objects, by looking at these receipts. And I think it's very valuable because, as you say, I knew that there were some girls. I knew that there were a lot of kids, and there's always one line, Edward was a pretty decent family man, and that's all you get. And so I was surprised at how much information you could get out of this. So if we can take one thing away from this book, what would you say we need to take away from this book and the lessons you've learned or the people that you've learned about from writing this? What should we take away from this?
Be careful about the way that we as historians sometimes project our assumptions about what these people would have been like or what knowledge we might be able to gain about them into the past. So in this case, you know, finding the right source, and it's not always there, but sometimes it's there. You might be able to find out more than you think, and you might end up finding, I certainly didn't expect to find somebody like Joanna. You know, I certainly didn't expect to encounter somebody who was quite that bold, and yet there she is. You know, it would have been if I had just written this story as these poor, simple pawns, how sad for them, that actually would not have been true to who they were. It would have been projecting my image of them back onto the historic past. So one of the concerns I often have about when I read even contemporary historians talking about medieval women in the past, I find we often project our assumptions that they were victimized onto them. So I encountered something. I'm researching something else at the minute, and a historian kept referring to the shield of arms, the heraldic arms that were for that woman's family as her father's arms. So there was her husband's arms and her father's arms. And I think that she would have thought those were her arms, you know, those her family's arms. But the historians were saying it's her father's arms and her arms, and how sad that she's had to put her husband's arms, her father's arms, she's had to identify herself with these male symbols. Why do we think they thought those were male symbols? Why do we not think they thought those were family symbols and that they would see themselves in that? I mean, I see these women in terms of if you want to look at objects, there are a small number of objects that are associated with these women. They have heraldic insignia of England on them because I think these women felt ownership of that heraldic insignia, not because they thought it was their father's, but because they thought it was theirs. And I think that they perceived a role for themselves in this kind of machinery of court. You know, it's when I talked about that not just being a pawn and going out and being married off to somebody, but actually having an active role where you are going from England off to be somewhere for the good of England, and you're doing that actively, and you're performing that role with your life. And I think that it does a great injustice to people to say, to ignore the activeness of that role and to say it was a purely passive one.
Yeah, I think that
was much more long-winded, but maybe you can do something with it.
No, you know what? I'm going to leave that there. I think that you really have said it in a good way, in that these people were not passive in their own lives. And I think that, you know, your book and what we said today really illustrates that. That they are active participants in their own lives. You only get one life. They were living their lives, especially Mary.
Yeah, especially Mary.
I really appreciate you coming on to talk about this. I really enjoyed the book, and I think that you've kind of shown us a way of getting at women that maybe is not conventional or hasn't been conventional. So I really appreciate that. Thanks for coming to talk to us.
Nice to speak with you, Danielle.
Kelsey's book is called Daughters of Chivalry, The Forgotten Children of Edward I, and it's now available everywhere you find great books. To find out more about Kelsey and her work, you can visit her website, kelseywilsonlee.com. That's KelseyWilsonLee.com. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hey. Well, we have a very special piece this week. It's by Terry Barnes, and he's been in Iceland over the last few weeks, and he's been looking at how the island's medieval past affects its present day. So it's a really interesting piece, and it looks like Terry interviewed some like really fun people, interesting people there. And I recommend that. And we've also started a new series called In Search of the Once and Future King, which is James Turner looking at the changing character of King Arthur. So going all the way from the 13th century all the way into the 20th. So we have that. And let's not forget your latest piece.
Yeah, on stain removal.
Yes. So when we don't have like laundry detergent, this is what we need.
How to remove stains. Yeah. I'm really excited about this one, especially the steam cleaning one. So everyone should check that out and then read the original article.
Yeah, that's all on this week on the website. And please, if you're looking to sponsor us on Patreon, we have our book of the month. It takes you back to 3rd century China. And our next map is going to be on medieval London. So that and much more.
Sounds amazing. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support each and every month. Whether you're in it for the subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, the Medieval magazine, our book club, our exclusive medieval maps, or just because you're awesome, I really appreciate it. If you haven't checked out all our amazing rewards yet, you can find them all at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from princesses to medieval steam cleaning, follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sobalski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at all your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an unforgettable day.